From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
And what there is a flood of American money, none of it approved by Congress, into the government of Lebanon, which is Sunni, the government of Prime Minister Senyora. And they, in turn, funnel it into various, at least three different Sunni jihadist groups.
Investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, speaking in February, he warned the U.S. and Saudi governments are covertly backing militant Sunni groups as part of an overarching foreign policy against Iran and growing Shia influence. Is Fatah al-Islam battling the Lebanese army now one of those groups? Seymour Hersh will join us to explain, and we'll go to Lebanon to get the latest in the conflict. Then Amnesty International issues its new report on the state of human rights around the world.
The U.S. administration is treating the world as one giant battlefield for its war on terror. And more evidence surfaced in 2006 to show how suspects were kidnapped, arrested, detained, tortured, and transferred from one secret prison to another across the world with impunity and with the complicity of allies.
And the Democratic-led House is expected to agree today to give President Bush over $90 billion to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, with no timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. We'll be joined by Congressmember Dennis Kucinich to talk about war and oil. Who gets it? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. More than 100 Iraqi civilians were killed, another 130 injured in attacks Wednesday around Iraq. 20 people died in a suicide attack in the northeast town of Mandalay. Meanwhile, the U.S. military announced the death of 9 U.S. troops. Military officials confirmed a body found in the Euphrates River was that of a U.S. soldier captured by Iraqi insurgents last month. With 8 days left in the month, May caps the deadliest six-month period for U.S. troops since the start of the war, with 540 killed. The Bush administration has declassified intelligence, it says, proves links between Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda operatives in Iraq. The 2005 report says bin Laden ordered former al-Qaeda in Iraq leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi to attack U.S. targets outside Iraq. President Bush discussed the charges at a speech for Coast Guard graduates in Connecticut.
Democratic Iraq is a threat to their ambitions to impose their hateful ideology across the Middle East. Al-Qaeda knows that our presence in Iraq is a direct threat to their existence in Iraq. Our security depends on helping the Iraqis succeed and defeating Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
White House aides later denied accusations of releasing selective intelligence and repeating its false linkage of bin Laden to Iraq before the U.S. invasion. As President Bush spoke yesterday, hundreds of people protested outside. The United Nations Agency for Children, UNICEF, has launched a new appeal amidst what it calls a worsening crisis for Iraq's youth. UNICEF says most Iraqi children have suffered trauma since the U.S. invasion. Only 30% have access to safe drinking water. This is UNICEF's Roger Wright.
It's obviously going to be a troubled generation. As the children are growing up, they may have, if they've not been directly exposed to the violence, they've seen it and witnessed and are suffering psychosocially from the experience.
In the occupied territories, Israeli troops have arrested more than 30 officials in the Hamas-led Palestinian government. Those detained include the Palestinian education minister, 3 lawmakers, and 3 mayors. Israel says it made the arrests because the officials had supported the firing of rockets into Israeli territory. The raids followed a series of Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip that wounded several people, including a pregnant woman and a teenage boy. On Capitol Hill, a former senior aide to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has testified in the ongoing investigation into the firing of at least 8 U.S. attorneys. Monica Goodling served as the Justice Department's liaison to the White House up until last month. On Wednesday, Goodling said Gonzalez had asked her to compare notes on the chronology of the firings just as scrutiny intensified. Gonzalez has denied discussing the firings with other officials during the investigation. Goodling also accused former Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty of giving inaccurate testimony to Congress on the firings. Goodling denied having a major role in the scandal, but indicated she had broken the law. She was questioned by Congressmember Bobby Scott.
Were there any laws that you could have broken by taking political considerations into account, quote, on some occasions?
The best I can say is that I know I took political considerations into account on some occasions.
Was that legal?
Sir, I'm not able to answer that question. I know I crossed the line.
The Senate has voted to limit the number of guest workers that would be allowed in the United States under the proposed immigration bill. On Wednesday, senators approved an amendment that would cap the program at 200,000 workers. The original bill proposed as many as 600,000 workers, but only until the expiration of their permit. Critics say the provision will depress wages and create a new underclass of workers. The overall bill has come under intense criticism from immigrant rights advocates. This is Maywood, California resident Maribel Nunez.
The new, because the Mexicans are the only ones that do any work here. Nobody does work but the Mexicans, and now they don't want them. But if it was a war, they'll call them to fight, but not to work. I don't know what to say. It just gives me mad.
Amnesty International is accusing the United States of turning the world into a global battlefield in the so-called war on terror. On Wednesday, Amnesty issued its annual report on the state of human rights. The criticism of the United States was multifold. Amnesty called for Guantanamo to be shut down, for senior government officials to be held accountable for authorizing torture, and for an end to the practice known as extraordinary rendition. Amnesty's report also highlighted human rights abuses in many other areas, including Iraq, Russia, and Zimbabwe, and Sudan. This is Amnesty International Secretary General Irene Khan.
Darfur is a bleeding wound on the world's conscience. The U.S. government has been outspoken on the need to protect civilians in Darfur, and we welcome that very much. But nothing proves more clearly the loss of U.S. moral authority than its failure to persuade the Sudanese government to accept U.N. peacekeepers.
For Israel and the occupied territories, Amnesty says Israel killed more than 650 Palestinians last year, three times the number of Palestinians killed in 2005. Half the Palestinians killed last year were unarmed civilians. The Palestinian death toll included 120 children. During the same period, Palestinian militants killed 27 Israelis, including 20 civilians and one child. We'll be speaking with Amnesty International Executive Director Larry Cox later in the broadcast. In Turkey, activists with the environmentalist group Greenpeace have built a model of Noah's Ark to raise awareness on global warming ahead of next month's G8 summit. This is Greenpeace campaign leader Wolfgang Sadik.
The answer in this myth was a flood, a climate catastrophe, and that's exactly what's going to happen now. So the sins of the human beings is sins against the environment and nature. And if we don't stop that immediately and do everything against that, it can happen that we get a new flood or a new climate catastrophe.
Pope Benedict XVI is refusing to apologize after claiming the Catholic Church purified indigenous peoples during the colonization of the Americas. On Wednesday, the Pope said he would only acknowledge that injustices were committed.
The memories of a glorious past cannot ignore the shadows that accompanied the process of evangelization of the Latin American continent. It is not possible, in fact, to forget the suffering and injustices that were inflicted upon the indigenous peoples when often their fundamental human rights were trampled upon.
Pope Benedict has come under intense criticism from Latin American leaders, including Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, who accused him of ignoring a Holocaust. In Colombia, nearly 300,000 teachers walked off the job Wednesday in a strike against planned cuts to education. Protest organizers have linked the cuts to a pending U.S. trade deal. This is protester Martin Rios.
The reason for the strike is to protest against the National Development Plan that cuts down the resources for public education and for the universities. Because of the cuts in education and health care that are going to cause more children to die of hunger.
In Oregon, an environmental activist involved in a series of arsons has been sentenced to 13 years in prison after a judge ruled the man should be considered a terrorist. Stanislaus Myrov was arrested in 2005 and admitted to being a member of the Earth Liberation Front. Meyerhoff faced up to 30 years in prison, but his sentence was decreased because he'd become a government informant. Nine other environmental and animal rights activists will be sentenced on similar charges in coming weeks. Federal prosecutors have requested all of them be considered terrorists, even though their actions cause no injuries. The Oregon-based Civil Rights Outreach Committee said the activists should not be considered terrorists. The group said the court's decision sets a dangerous precedent that could be exploited by the federal government to seek greater prison time for political activists engaged in acts of civil disobedience. Here in New York, the city's chief medical examiner has for the first time linked a death to dust exposure from the attack on the World Trade Center. In a letter released Wednesday, Dr. Charles Hirsch says he's certain beyond a reasonable doubt that toxic dust from the debris contributed to the death of 42-year-old civil rights lawyer Felicia Dunn Jones. Jones was engulfed as she fled the attacks from her office just one block away from the Trade Center. She developed respiratory problems and died 5 months later of sarcoidosis. Dr. Hirsch's decision could have a major impact on how the city deals with the growing number of illnesses and deaths linked to toxic exposure from the 9/11 attacks. New York Congressmember Carolyn Maloney said, quote, "The city medical examiner has now accepted what thousands of people with 9/11-related illnesses and their doctors have long understood, that ground zero dust was harmful and even deadly," she said. The U.S. Office of Special Counsel has determined a top government official violated federal law by instructing employees to help Republicans win the 2008 elections. During a meeting in January, General Services Administration Chief Loretta Alexis Doane is said to have asked employees how they could, quote, help our candidates. Investigators say Doane has violated the Hatch Act, which restricts top officials from using their positions for political motives. In media news, the Ethiopian government has released three journalists with the New York Times after a five-day detention. The New York Times says the journalists were interrogated at gunpoint and stripped of all their equipment, including cameras, phones, and notebooks. And finally, in Israel, the sociologist Baruch Kimmerling has died after a long battle with cancer. He was 67 years old. Kimmerling was an outspoken critic of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. He was identified as one of the new Israeli historians who helped challenge the dominant views of Israel's history and its treatment of Palestinians. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. Well, Lebanon's defense minister has said Islamist militants entrenched in a Palestinian refugee camp must surrender or face further military action. The ultimatum followed 3 days of fierce fighting between the army and the Fatah al-Islam group. The army has laid siege to the Nahar al-Bared camp since the fighting erupted on Sunday, bombarding it with tank fire and artillery shells. At least 80 people have died, with dozens more wounded. On Wednesday, an informal ceasefire enabled thousands of residents to flee the camp. Some headed for another Palestinian refugee camp nearby, while others traveled to the neighboring city of Tripoli. The International Committee of the Red Cross estimates between 13 and 15,000 refugees have left Nahar al-Bared. The camp is home to 30,000 people. The internal conflict is the bloodiest in Lebanon since the civil war ended 17 years ago.
The Lebanese government accuses Fatah al-Islam of having ties with al-Qaeda and the Syrian government. But there's another theory of who's backing the militant group, the Lebanese government itself, along with the United States. Last March, investigative journalist Seymour Hirsch reported in the New Yorker magazine that the U.S. and Saudi governments are covertly backing militant Sunni groups like Fatah al-Islam as part of an overarching foreign policy against Iran and growing Shia influence. Seymour Hirsch joins us now on the phone from his home in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!,
Sam. Good morning.
Can you explain what you learned?
Well, very simply, this was over the winter. The government made it, I think the article was called The Redirection. There was a major change in policy by the United States government, essentially, which was that we were going to, the American government would join with the Brits and other Western allies, and with what we call the moderate Sunni governments, that is the governments of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, and join with them and with Israel to fight the Shia. One of the major goals for America, of course, was the obsession the Bush White House has with Iran. And the other obsession they have is, of course, is and fear is of Hezbollah, the party of God that is so dominant, in the Shia party of God that's so dominant in southern Lebanon that wants, and whose leader, Nasan Hasrallah, wants to play a bigger political role and is doing quite a bit to get there and is in direct confrontation with Sinjora. And so you have a situation where the Sunni government, pretty much in control now, the American-supported Sunni government, headed by Fardo Sinjora, who was a deputy or an aide to Rafiq Hariri, the slain leader of Lebanon. That government has, we know, the International Crisis Group reported a couple of years ago that the son, Saad Hariri, the son of Rafiq Hariri, who's now a major player in the parliament of Lebanon, he put up $40,000 bail to free four Sunni fundamentalists, jihadists, Salafists, what you will, who were tied directly to, well, we, you know, this word al-Qaeda is sort of ridiculous. They were tied to jihadist groups. And God knows that al-Qaeda, in terms of Osama bin Laden, doesn't have much to do with what we're talking about. These are independently, more or less, you could call them fanatical jihadists. And so the goal of part of the goal of the problem of in Lebanon, part of the way this policy played out was with Saudi help, Prince Bandar, if you remember him. We remember Prince Bandar, the Saudi prince, as a major player in Iran-Contra and also in the American effort two decades ago. If you remember, we supported Osama bin Laden and other jihadists in Afghanistan against the Russians. And that didn't work out so well, but we went right back to the well again, and we began supporting some of these jihadist groups, and particularly in the article I did name Fatah al-Islam. The idea was to provide them with some arms and some money and some basic equipment. So these are small units, a couple hundred people. There were three or four around the country given the same help covertly, the goal being they would be potential enemies of Hezbollah in case of warfare, in case Nasrallah decided to do something physical, get kinetic. In Lebanon, the Sunni Sinjora government would have some very tough guys on its side, period. That's the policy.
Well, Saad Hirsch, if that is true, then what has led to the current fighting now? If the Lebanese government had been backing the group, why is it now attacking it?
Well, first of all, the Lebanese army is very distinct. Let me begin by saying nobody really knows anything right now. I mean, there's a lot. One of the things about crises is you learn that we really get to play much later. But based on common sense and what I'm reading, the Lebanese army has maintained an amazing sort of neutrality, which is surprising. The army has not been a pawn of the Sinjora government. As you know, the American government, the American position right now, there's a standoff politically, and you cannot discuss what's going on without discussing the overall politics. There's a standoff politically right now, a very serious one, in Lebanon. The government's polarized. The government in power really has no legal basis to make any changes in cabinet positions, et cetera, because it's not a constitutional government, because Hezbollah, which had five members of the cabinet and a dozen or so members in the parliament, Hezbollah pulled out months ago, and there were street protests against Sinjora. And right now you have Hezbollah in league with a Christian leader named Aoun, a former chief of staff of the army. Aoun and Nasrallah are in an amazing partnership against the Sinjora government. And where this breaks down and who's going to win this standoff, it's been going on since last December, isn't clear. America totally supports Sinjora. But there's a big, brutal fight going. And the Lebanese army stayed out of it. And was pretty much very much independent in the sense that when there were street demonstrations, they did not beat up on the Nasrallah people. They were very impartial. So I think the story that we have is that there was a crime and they were chasing people into one of the Palestinian camps, which are always hotbeds. God knows the Palestinians are the end of the stick for not only for the West, but also for the Arab world. Nobody pays much attention to them, and those places. I've been to Tripoli and been into the camps, and they are seething, as they should be. You know, rational people don't like being mistreated. And in any case, so what you have is what seems to me just a series The word you could use is unintended consequences. I don't think anybody in the Señora government anticipated that the people they were covertly supporting to some degree. I got an email the other day, and I have not checked this out, from somebody who was in the community, in the intelligence community, and still consults with the community. He says, why don't we ask more about the American arms that the fighters of Fatah al-Islam are brandishing? I don't know if that's true or not, but I did get that email. And so that could be true. Both Saudi money and American money, not directly but indirectly, was fed into these groups. And what is a laugh riot, and the reason I'm actually talking to you you guys about this, I usually don't like to do interviews unless I have a story in the New Yorker. The reason I'm talking about it is because the American government keeps on putting out this story that Syria is behind the Fatah group, which is just beyond belief. There's no way. It may be possible, but the chances of it are very slight, simply because Syria is a very big supporter, obviously, of Nasrallah. And Bashar Assad has told me that he's in awe of Nasrallah, that he worships at his feet and has great respect for him. The idea that the Syrians would be sponsoring a Sunni jihadist group whose sole mission are to kill the apostates, that is, anybody who doesn't support their view of the Wahhabi or Salafist view of Sunni religion, that includes the Shia. Anybody who doesn't believe, support these guys' religions, are apostates and are killable. That's basically one of the crazy aspects of all this. And it's just inconceivable. Nothing can be ruled out, but that doesn't make much case. And I noticed that in the papers today, there's fewer and fewer references to this. The newspapers in America are beginning to wise up that this can't be, this isn't very logical. The White House is putting it out hot and heavy as part of the anti-Syria campaign, but it's not flying because it doesn't make sense. So there we are. It's another mess. You might think that one of the reasons, I think I wrote about this in the New Yorker, one of the things that the Saudi Bonder had promised us was that we can control the jihadists. We can control them. He assured us, don't worry about getting in bed with these bad guys, because if you remember, the same kind of assurances were given to us in the late 1980s when we supported, as I said, bin Laden and others in the war against Russia, the Mujahideen war. And that, of course, bit us on the ass, and this is too. So there we are.
Seymour Hersh, what about the role of Vice President Dick Cheney, the Deputy National Security Advisor, Elliot Abrams?
Well, anytime you have a violent anti-Iran policy and anti-Shia policy, you have to start looking there. I look, clearly this president is deeply involved in this, too. But what I hear from my people, of course, the players, it's always Cheney. Cheney meets with Bush at least once a week. They have a lunch. They usually have a scheduled lunch. And out of that comes a lot of big decisions. We don't know what's ever said at that meeting. And this is talk about not being talk about being opaque. this is a government that is so hidden from us. I can tell you that, the thing that's amazing about this government, the thing that's really spectacular is even now, how they can get their way, mostly with a lot of the American press. For example, I do know, and you have to take it on face value. If you've been reading me for a long time, you know a lot of the things I write are true or come out to be more or less true. I do know that within the last month, maybe four and a half weeks ago, they made a decision that because of the totally dwindling support for the war in Iraq, we'd go back to the Al-Qaeda card. And we start talking about Al-Qaeda. And the next thing you know, right after that, Bush went to the Southern Command. This was a month ago, and mentioned Al-Qaeda 27 times in a speech. He did so just the other day, this week. Well, Al-Qaeda this, Al-Qaeda that. All of a sudden, the poor Iraqi Sunnis, I mean, they can't do anything without Al-Qaeda. It's only Al-Qaeda that's dropping the bombs and causing mayhem. It's not the Sunni and Shia insurgents or militias. And this policy just gets picked up. Although there's absolutely no empirical basis. Most of the pros will tell you the foreign fighters are a couple of percent, and then they're sort of leadership, leaderless in the sense that there's no overall direction of the various foreign fighters. You could call them Al-Qaeda. You can also call them jihadists and Salafists that want to die fighting the Americans or the occupiers in Iraq, and they come across the border. Whether this is there's no attempt to suggest there's any significant coordination of these groups by bin Laden or anybody else. And the press just goes gaga. And so they went gaga a little bit over the Syrian connection to the activities in Tripoli. It's just amazing to me, you guys.
Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, writes for The New Yorker magazine, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. When we come back, we go to Lebanon. Then we'll be speaking with Congressmember and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich. He spent an hour on the House floor talking about the proposed new Iraq law. We're also going to talk about how the Democratic-led Congress is voting with President Bush to give $90 billion for war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we go now to Lebanon to speak with Rania Masri, assistant professor in the Faculty of Sciences at the University of Balamand in Lebanon. She's currently in the Badawi refugee camp in northern Lebanon. Alistair Crook also joins us. He's founder of Conflicts Forum based in Beirut, former British intelligence agent for 30 years and former special Mideast advisor to European Union High Representative Javier Solana. Rania Masri, you're in the camp where thousands of refugees from the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp have fled. What do you see there?
Well, if I could, before I go into what I see in the Badawi camp, just one small correction, if I may, Amy. I've been hearing this a lot in the Western press, that the violence that we are seeing right now in Lebanon is, quote, the worst since the civil war. Unfortunately, that's not quite true. The worst violence we had since the civil war was the Israeli war last year in July. So if you can just remember, this country has not healed from the July war last summer. With that, what we have in the Badawi camp, if we can just, the Badawi camp has approximately 15,000 refugees in it already. The number of refugees now in the Badawi camp has almost doubled because we have approximately 12,000 refugees from the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp who are now in the Badawi camp. That alone could give you an idea of the amount of lack of goods that are now available in the camp. I mean, there is a lack of extraordinarily basic goods, be it medicine, be it foods, be it mattresses, be it anything. Every individual that we talked to, every agency that we talked to said the same thing, which is that the international agencies have not operated quickly enough to be able to respond to the presence of 12,000 refugees almost overnight in this already extraordinarily impoverished camp of the Badawi camp. Approximately 25% of these refugees are going to schools, another 75% are going to homes. Unfortunately, the vast majority of the aid, approximately 80% of the aid, is going to those individuals in the schools. 20% of aid is going to the 75% of the refugees in the homes, which means we are having an extraordinarily lack of goods that are being given to the people most in need. When we look at this situation and when we keep in mind the ultimatum that's been given by the Minister of Defense, which is this threat of actually invading the Nahr al-Bared camp, then we can envision at the very least that the number of refugees we now have in the Badawi camp from the refugee camp in Nahr al-Bared is probably going to increase. So as bad and as horrific as the situation is currently in the Badawi camp, we are expecting it to actually get worse tomorrow.
And in terms of how the fighting is progressing in the Nahr al-Bared camp, what is the situation right now, as far as you can tell?
Well, there has been a quote-unquote truce for almost a day and a half. But one thing I do want to emphasize with regards to the violence, and again, this is based upon a numerous amount of eyewitness reports, that the violence isn't simply extraordinarily indiscriminate heavy artillery coming from the Lebanese army into this, let me stress again, one of the most impoverished Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, which is the Nahr al-Bared camp. In addition to getting this heavy artillery from the Lebanese army, in addition to that, there is a third factor. There probably is an armed civilian camp, you know, group, militia that is operating outside of the Nahr al-Bared refugee camp that is attacking both the refugees that are leaving as well as lobbying sniper attacks into the camp itself. So not only do we have the Palestinians in the camp stuck between Fatah al-Islam, which is a non-Palestinian radical organization, and the Lebanese army, they are also stuck between this third armed civilian militia group.
And what's been the position or the attitude of Hezbollah to all of this that has been occurring in the last few days?
The position of almost every single Lebanese political party, and I say this, all the strong Lebanese political parties, of course, including Hezbollah, has been support for the Lebanese army. The Hezbollah leadership have made gentle requests that the civilians on both sides of the conflict, Lebanese and Palestinian, not be harmed, that there be attempts to try to minimize the loss of civilian life. But the response from almost all Lebanese politicians and all the Lebanese political parties is support behind the Lebanese army. And here, and I want to add something to the comments that Seymour Hersh made. This is being presented, this conflict is being presented by, I would say, a strong segment of both the Lebanese population and almost all the Palestinians within the refugee camps as a conspiracy against both the Lebanese and the Palestinians, and as a conspiracy that includes within it a conspiracy against the Lebanese army.
I wanted to bring in Alistair Crook, a founder of Conflicts Forum based in Beirut, former British intelligence agent for almost 30 years. Can you talk, follow up on what Seymour Hersh was explaining about who Fatah al-Islam is and its connection to the Lebanese government, possibly to the U.S. government, and the arming of this group?
Yes. I think it's probably worth for your listeners just to understand a little bit more about the nature of this group. Although it came from Syria into Lebanon, and it came from a group that was associated with Palestinians, its name was Fatah also, and was an old, mainly Palestinian group that existed in Syria from the days of the Oslo Accord. What we have in Lebanon is something quite unrelated to the Palestinian issue. This is an extreme Sunni group. It's a Salafi group, as Seymour described it, which means that their main characteristic is not concern about Palestine or a Palestinian state, but their main concern is their antagonism and their hatred for the Shia. And I think the reason that we saw them in Lebanon probably had something to do also with the conflict this summer that took place last summer with Israel and the aftermath of that, which seemed to presage an internal conflict within Lebanon, possibly between the Shia and the Sunni, and with Christians involved as well. In other words, there was a real fear at some stages that Lebanon could be tipping back towards civil war. And I think in this context, therefore, this group, which is virulently anti-Shia, came across with the idea of defending the Sunnis. Of those that have been killed in this group so far, not one of them has been Palestinian. It's true that the leader is Palestinian, but the other members of it that have been taken so far have turned out to be Saudi, Tunisian, Yemeni, and Lebanese, but not Palestinians. So they ended up in this refugee camp. They forced their way in. There's not much refugees can do when 200 determined and armed men enter your camp.
and eventually set up a little satellite area of their own adjacent to the camp. So I think that's the context that you have to see this. And I think some Sunnis in Lebanon welcomed their arrival, if you like, as potential reinforcement. If you wanted someone to take on the ranks of Hezbollah, which is a Shia movement, then here was a determined group who hated them that could be co-opted on the basis of your enemy's enemy is your friend. So I think this is very much the way in which to see what happened. And I think it's quite true what Seymour said. In a sense, it's a reflection of a wider policy. It's not that someone sat down in a pin and said, we're going to give support to this particular group and build them up. I think the rhetoric and the language that is being used by the United States and by Europe in some cases of trying to encourage, if you like, Sunni fears about a Shia threat and a Shia menace, the axis of or the crescent of Shia threat that faces the region, gives the opportunity and gives the space to these sort of groups to emerge, and quite often ends with them getting the support and the financial resources that they require.
Alistair Crook, I want to thank you for being with us, founder of Conflicts Forum, speaking to us from Beirut, former British intelligence agent for almost 30 years, Rania Masri, assistant professor, Faculty of Sciences at the University of Balamand in Lebanon, speaking to us from the Badawi refugee camp. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we go to Washington, D.C., to Capitol Hill. Juan.
Well, on Capitol Hill, the House is expected to agree today to give President Bush $96 billion to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. In a major victory for the Bush administration, the Democratic leadership has abandoned its effort to include a non-binding timetable for withdrawal from the Iraq war, from the spending bill. The Democrats made the concession after President Bush vetoed an earlier bill that included a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. forces. Democrats say they do not have enough votes to override a veto and want to avoid accusations of denying funding for U.S. troops.
Anti-war groups have harshly criticized the Democratic leadership. United for Peace and Justice accused the Democrats of supporting a disastrous war and occupation. The group Win Without War said this decision marks a, quote, complete capitulation to a failed president and a failed policy. We're now joined by one of the leading anti-war voices on Capitol Hill, Congressmember and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich of Ohio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Congressmember Kucinich.
Thank you. Good morning, Amy.
What is your assessment of this?
Well, you know, there's a fundamental misperception about the path the Democrats should be taking. We shouldn't be offering any legislation at all. We should just simply tell the president we're not going to fund the war. And this idea about funding the war to help the troops is absurd. You want to help the troops, bring them home. I offered a plan, H.R. 1234, that would provide for a plan that would bring the troops home, close the bases, end the occupation, and reach out to the international community for an international peacekeeping and security force that would move in as our troops leave. But we can't do that until we end the occupation. We can't end the occupation until we start, until we stop funding the war. We simply do not have to have a bill, Amy. It's just as simple as that.
What about those Democrats who argue that they could not get a majority vote for or at least one that would survive a presidential veto to stop the funding, so that they've got to then have a concession of some sort?
I want to make sure I'm being clear about this. I'm saying that it's not necessary to have a bill, that the process depends on legislation to keep the war going. But there's money in the pipeline right now to bring the troops home. We simply should tell the president we're not going to fund the war, period. We don't need legislation to do that. And the idea that somehow we need to fund the war to help the troops, again, it's an absurd thought, and we need to start to reorient ourselves to getting out of Iraq. This administration isn't going to do that. And frankly, the Democratic Congress is failing the American people at this moment.
Congressmember Kucinich, you spoke for about an hour on the floor of the House about the proposed Iraq oil law. Can you talk about this?
Yes. It's really not too well known in, on Capitol Hill, but the benchmarks that the administration has been insisting upon, and now the benchmarks are in the Warner Amendment that will be included in this legislative process that will keep us in Iraq, include a provision that insists that the Iraqi government pass a Hydrocarbon Act. The benchmark says it's about equitable sharing of revenues. That's three lines, vaguely worded lines, in a 33-page document that's all about the restructuring of the Iraq oil industry to permit multinational oil corporations to take over 80% of Iraq's oil. I mean, this is a criminal action that is going on here, and we ought to be standing up against it and challenging it. We have no right to take Iraq's oil or to facilitate the acquisition of Iraq's oil on behalf of multinational corporations.
And in terms of even within Iraq, this law has seems to be going nowhere, obviously, because of the contending forces there. What do you think in terms of an actual act that would permit the possibility of continuing a legalized framework for the trading of oil from Iraq that should occur?
Well, first of all, this is a question that is for the people of Iraq to decide when they're not under occupation. You have to keep in mind that this process that the Bush administration has been pushing began even before the invasion of Iraq. They were meeting with oil companies, looking at how they could create a beachhead, essentially, in the Middle East. And they've been looking at the prize of Iraq oil for many years now. And so you have to remember that even though it looks like this legislation isn't going anywhere, there is enormous pressure being put on the Iraqi government. And you can bet that before too long, they'll put the kind of pressure on them that the Iraqi government will break, will relent, and go ahead and pass this law that will permit about 80% of its oil to be controlled by multinational oil companies. Now, keep in mind that Iraq has as many as 300 billion barrels of oil. At a market price that looks like it's going towards $70 a barrel, you could be talking about $21 trillion worth of oil, 80% of which will be under the control of multinational oil companies if it's up to the Bush administration. This is a crime, literally. And so I'm challenging it. I'm letting the Congress know about it. And I'm going to keep an eye on this because I think it's the basis for a war crime charge.
I wanted to read from the Cleveland Plain Dealer, your hometown paper. It says it's all about Iraq's oil, rich, abundant, coveted by multinational companies waiting to line their deep pockets. Or so said Congressman Dennis Kucinich Wednesday in an unusual hour-long address on the House floor. He laid out his contention that the White House and Democratic-led Congress are helping oil companies grab a stake in Iraq's vast oil fields while claiming to be interested merely in winding down the Iraq war. The claim has brought Kucinich derision within his own Democratic Party. Leaders reject the suggestion that they would help privatize Iraqi oil, and Republicans dismiss him altogether, with Republican Party spokesman Dan Renane saying, it sounds like Congressman Kucinich is trying to get noticed with a nutty conspiracy theory. Your response, Congressman Kucinich?
Well, if you look at the facts, and the facts speak for themselves, prior to the invasion of Iraq, Vice President Cheney was meeting with oil company executives. They were planning this takeover of Iraqi oil. You know, everyone knows that it has one of the largest oil supplies in the world. This war has been about oil from the beginning. And I've been one of the few people who's been willing to challenge it and say that. And I think the American people need to know that our government has been instrumental in trying to push the privatization of Iraq oil for the profit of multinational oil companies. Our soldiers shouldn't be there in Iraq. We need to bring our troops home. And when someone looks at the long test of truth over the last 5 years, I'm the one who's been telling the truth. This administration has not told the truth. And some of my colleagues in Congress have kept their head in the sand while there's been enormous catastrophe in Iraq, loss of life there, loss of lives of our troops, up to over $500 billion wasted already in American taxpayers' funds. I mean, someone has to stand for the truth here. Someone has to stand for the Constitution, and that's what I'm doing.
Congressman Kucinich, I'd like to ask you also about the U.S. attorney scandal and yesterday's congressional testimony by former Justice Department official Monica Goodling. Up until last month, Goodling had served as department's liaison to the White House, and she denied having a major role in the firings of the attorneys, but she accused Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty of misleading Congress. She was questioned by Democratic Congresswoman Linda Sanchez of California.
Things did you specifically brief him on that you felt he was not entirely forthcoming before Congress when he testified?
He was asked whether the White House was involved in any way, and he said, well, these are presidential appointments, so I'm sure White House personnel was informed at some point. Certainly...
And why would that not be a complete answer?
I think because of the way it came across, I think people believed he was downplaying the role to a certain extent. And the White House had been involved for several... He was aware that the department had worked for at least several months with the White House, and that many offices in the White House had signed off, and that they were, in fact, participating in making phone calls and different sorts of things with members.
That was Monica Goodling. Your response, Congressmember Kucinich.
I think there's a chill that's settled over America with the thought that the Justice Department process in this country has been politicized. When you look at the statue of justice, Lady Justice has a blindfold because justice is supposed to be impartial. What we see here is the possibility that the quality of justice in this country has been determined by politics. And I think that ought to be a great concern to all the American people.
I'd like to ask you also about the immigration situation right now. Obviously, the Senate has begun debate on an immigration bill. And what's your sense of this bipartisan compromise and what may happen in the House?
Well, we have to see the language, but I think that someone needs to say, and I'm willing to say it, that the basis of this whole battle over immigration ignores the fact that the waves of immigration started right after NAFTA passed. Wages collapsed in Mexico. Migrants came across the border seeking a chance for a better wage and a better life. I'm saying that we need to go back to NAFTA. We need to cancel NAFTA and cancel the WTO, go back to bilateral trade conditioned on workers' rights, human rights, and environmental quality principles. Once we have a trade agreement between the United States and Mexico that's based on workers' rights and a decent wage, then workers in Mexico can be assured that they can have a decent living. They don't have to go north of the border and seeking that opportunity. People should have a chance to make the money where they live, but they haven't been able to do that because of these trade laws. We need to stop attacking these migrant workers, because actually what's been happening is they're the victims of a system that has enabled corporations to make great profits using a cheap supply of labor. This has been a disgrace in this country, where we've actually supported a form of slave labor, and that has to stop. People who have been in this country and have been contributing to this country should have a path to legalization. We need to have certainly some control at the borders. But I'll tell you, the way this whole immigration thing has been couched, I think, has done a disservice to the proud tradition of this country in welcoming immigrants from all around the world.
Back to the Attorney General. Do you think Alberto Gonzalez should resign?
Of course he should. But he's not the only one who should resign. I mean, this administration has been responsible for conducting an illegal war, for lying to the American people about the cause of a war. I mean, I've submitted legislation to impeach the vice president. I think the president has to be called to an accountability. I think the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, and others should be subject to serious questions whether or not they should be prosecuted for war crimes. I mean, there are some serious issues here related to governance. And here's the thing, Amy. Whoever would be the next president, and I'm hoping that it's going to be me, that we have to ask, what will their standards be? If we don't challenge this conduct of office right now, we're raising the bar for expectations so low that we can have a criminal in the White House next time around, and who cares? I care. The American people should care.
Do you think
we should want the Constitution protected?
Do you think the Democratic-led Congress has failed the American people right now?
Absolutely. Are you kidding? This isn't even a close question. We were elected in November to end the war. That's why people voted Democrat. That's why they gave us control of the House and the Senate. And they expected us to take a new direction. They didn't want a Democratic version of the war, and they didn't want to be told later on, well, we just don't have the votes. Well, you know what? You don't need the votes to say no. You just don't offer any legislation at all.
Congressmember Kucinich, I want to thank you for being with us, Ohio Congressman and Democratic presidential candidate. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Amnesty International has issued its annual report. We'll speak with the executive director. Stay with us.
Just another day outside of Baghdad. I was assigned to the raid. Was a 22-year-old sergeant with a wife and two kids back in the States. Everything had gone as well as it could. No one had shot at us, no one had run. I was questioning a woman in the courtyard when I heard the sound of a machine gun. I dreamed of the mountain.
Home Uninjured by Amy Martin, sent in to us by listeners and viewers. If you have music you'd like to hear on Democracy Now!, send it to us at mail@democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Amnesty International is accusing the United States of turning the world into a global battlefield in the so-called war on terror. That charge appears in Amnesty's new report on the state of human rights around the world. Amnesty is calling for Guantanamo to be shut down, for senior government officials to be held accountable for authorizing torture, and for an end to the practice known as extraordinary rendition. The authors of the Amnesty report write, quote, "The U.S. administration's doublespeak has been breathtakingly shameless. It is unrepentant about the global web of abuse it has spun in the name of counterterrorism."
Amnesty's report also highlights human rights abuses around the globe, including Sudan, the occupied territories, Iraq, Russia, Zimbabwe. The report states Israel killed more than 650 Palestinians last year, three times the number of Palestinians killed in 2005. Half the Palestinians killed last year were unarmed civilians. The Palestinian death toll included 120 children. During the same period, Palestinian militants killed 27 Israelis, including 20 civilians and one child. As for Iraq, Amnesty found, quote, "the worst practices of Saddam's regime, torture, unfair trials, capital punishment, and rape with impunity, remain very much alive." Larry Cox is executive director of Amnesty International USA. He joins us in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What do you think are the most important issues you want to highlight right now?
Well, I think you've already highlighted them. I think the most serious challenge we have to human rights in practice and to the idea of human rights is unfortunately the open defiance by the United States, not because it's the worst country in terms of human rights violations, but because its example is so powerful. It is a superpower, and when it openly defies human rights in the way that it has, openly violates the most fundamental human rights and justifies those violations, it spreads around the globe. It has a terrible impact.
You start with the Military Commissions Act.
Well, the Military Commissions Act sort of brings together many of these practices. Holding people without access to a court, without charging them, without trying them, setting up military commissions that can use evidence that has been obtained through coercion that no normal court would accept, denying habeas to people, one of the oldest protections and a very important protection against abuse and against torture around the world. These are all practices that historically the United States in recent decades has criticized severely when other countries have carried it out. Now we're doing it. So where is our moral authority? Where is our credibility when we go to Egypt, for example, and say you should not have military commissions? When we go to Egypt and say you should not be carrying out torture? When we have, in fact, sent people to Egypt knowing that they would be tortured.
You say in the report that far too many leaders are trampling freedom and trumpeting ever-widening range of fears, fears of being swamped by migrants, fears of being blown up by terrorists, and fears of rogue states with weapons of mass destruction. What about this issue of fear and its impact on populations not raising questions about any of this?
Well, this is the central reality of the world we're now in, where fear, instead of being met, and there are, of course, legitimate fears that people have, but instead of meeting those fears with effective ways of dealing with the causes of that fear, fear is being manipulated. Fear is being used. Fear is being exaggerated in order to justify what is, in fact, unjustifiable. You see it in around the globe. You see it in China, where, you know, every time someone's arrested now, it's terrorism. You see it in Russia, where, again, the threat of the conflict in Chechnya is now being used to widely justify restrictions on civil society. This use of fear is one of the most frightening aspects of the world we're now living in.
Larry Cox, the Bush administration has been fiercely critical of Amnesty's findings. On Wednesday, State Department spokesperson Tom Casey was asked about the report.
Have you read the Amnesty International report, which suggests that in the war on terror, the United States has been eroding human rights around the world?
Well, George, I think people will take a good look at the report. Certainly, I don't think anyone's had an opportunity to review it in depth. It's pretty clear that Amnesty International thought that we'd make a convenient ideological punching bag, and that's something that isn't, unfortunately, new. I think we personally wish that Amnesty International would have been a little more willing to do things like try and help out the Iraqis as they dealt with the trials of some of the worst war criminals who've been around for the last 50 years. And I think if you look at the report, unfortunately, it reads quite a bit more like a political document than a sort of honest review of human rights throughout the world.
That was the Bush administration, your response, Larry Cox.
Well, there's nothing unusual about these kinds of attacks. We've been getting these kinds of attacks from governments all around the world every time we criticize their human rights violations. We don't engage in ideology. We engage in facts. Now we have, unfortunately, a very sad collection of facts about the United States. The United States has openly admitted having secret detention sites, even said it boastfully, and that it will continue to have secret detention sites where people are kidnapped and taken. No one knows where they are. These are not things that Amnesty International has invented. These are the words of the President of the United States. We know that if we criticize strongly what a government is doing when a government is doing something wrong, that we're going to get these kind of attacks. There's nothing really new about them. It's just a very sad comment that instead of responding to these concerns, which are not Amnesty's concerns alone, but virtually every UN body, every other independent human rights organization around the world has raised the same charges. So you have to attack the entire body of human rights experts around the globe if you're the United States, because we're all saying the same thing.
And in terms of the ability of the United Nations to have any kind of impact on the human rights situation around the world?
Well, the United Nations depends upon leadership. And one of the reasons that we are so adamant about what the United States is doing is the way it has weakened the ability of multilateral organizations like the United Nations to play an effective role. That's most striking in the case of Darfur, where the world has stood by and watched as massive human rights violations take place and issued statements, but has not been able to put troops on the ground that could protect people. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is another one where, there has been no really effective move to correct a situation which continues to deteriorate. And U.S. leadership has been so undermined by U.S. practice that it's hard to imagine how the U.S. can now play a constructive role.
We only have a minute. You highlight unlawful killings by U.S. forces outside the USA, and here at home you talk about ill treatment in jails and police custody.
Yes, that's right. We're not only concerned about what is happening abroad, but we're also concerned about the violations of human rights here in the United States. So we have documented numerous cases where people are being ill-treated in prisons in the United States. And in fact, there's a link between, for example, what happens in maximum security prisons inside the United States and the kinds of treatments that we've seen at Abu Ghraib or in Guantanamo. So it's very important that the commitment to human rights means a commitment to human rights everywhere, not only abroad, but here at home as well.
Larry Cox, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Larry Cox is the executive director of Amnesty International USA. We will link to the Amnesty annual report on our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Mate, Angelique Kamat. Happy birthday to Mike DeFilippo. Happy birthday, Flip. Nick Marsilio and Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks also to Becca Staley, Hugh Grand, John Randolph, Jose Miranda, Jillian O'Connor, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, Samantha Chambly. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can sign up for our headlines and news stories. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!